Thank you for joining me. I'm Kimberly Rogers, and you're listening to this week's Torah portion from Friday sundown to Saturday sundown. This message is brought to you by themessianicmessage.com. themessianicmessage.com. I hope that you enjoy this teaching. This week's Torah portion is Vayishlach, and he sent. It starts at Genesis 32, verse 3, and goes to Genesis 36, 43. The Haftarah is Obadiah, chapter 1, verses 1 to 21. And the Brit Hadashah is Hebrews 11, verses 11 to 20, and Matthew 26, verses 36 to 46. Before we get started, let's say a word of prayer. Baruch atah Yehovah Eloheinu melech haolam. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe. We thank you for your Shabbats and for your Torah portions and Abba. I just ask that you would be in every word that I speak, and if I speak any of my own words, that your words only would prevail. I ask this in the name of Yeshua. Amen. In times past, I have expressed disappointment in Jacob for the way that he approached Esau in supplicating him and giving him gifts and so forth and so on. But I want to share with you a different perspective this year, because in Jasher, starting at Jasher chapter 31, verse 54, we learn that Laban sent messengers to see Esau after Laban and Jacob had made their covenant in last week's Torah portion. And Laban sends 10 men with his son to see Esau. You know, we have that 10 men thing keeps cropping up, right? That 10 men symbolism. It has something to do with prophecy and about how we're going to, in the end of days, be approaching Esau. Of course, in the end of days, we're going to destroy Esau. We're not going to supplicate him and, you know, give him presents and, you know, those kinds of things. But Jacob did, because we're being shown that when you meet up, go to the land, that you meet up with Esau. And so, rather than being disappointed with Jacob, I decided this year to look into the book of Jasher, and I found out that Jacob had been forewarned by Laban that, Esau had been forewarned by Laban that Jacob was coming, and Laban told Esau that God had blessed him, and that Jacob had been blessed because God blessed Laban. You see, Laban twisted that around, even though Jacob had clearly said to Laban, God blessed you because of me. Laban went to Esau and said that Jacob stole Laban's blessing. Okay? Now, this brings to mind what Esau believes he has suffered at the hands of Jacob, and so now he is inflamed toward Jacob and goes out to make war with him. That's the purpose of those 400 men. According to the book of Jasher, they sent out 400 men who were armed, you see. But not only did Laban's messengers go to Esau, they went to Rebekah. Now, Rebekah responds by sending 72 of her own men. And here's what she said. She sent messengers back to Jacob, and here's what she said to Jacob. And therefore, my son, hearken to my voice and see with your counsel what you will do. And when he, that's Esau, comes up to you, supplicate him, and do not speak rashly to him, and give him a present from what you possess and from what God has favored you with. And when he asks you concerning your affairs, conceal nothing from him. Perhaps he may turn from his anger against you, and you will thereby save your soul, you and all belonging to you. For it is your duty to honor him, for he is your elder brother. And when Jacob heard the words of his mother, which the messengers had spoken to him, Jacob lifted up his voice and wept bitterly, and did as his mother then commanded him. You know, it was his mother, and I believe that his mother and Isaac were working together when Isaac gave Jacob the blessing. But it was his mother who instructed Jacob on what to do. And now it looks like, probably from Jacob's viewpoint, that perhaps his mother has maybe turned on him, maybe changed his mind, or whatever. He weeps bitterly. But because he is a man of the tents, because he is an obedient son, he obeyed his mother. And so now you have some background story from the book of Jasher on why he approached Esau in the way that he did. He was actually honoring his mother. You know, there's a principle in the Torah that if the congregation fails to be obedient to the Lord, and it's because they do so because someone has led them to do so, like, you know, a leader, like your mother or your father in this instance, or the priests and the judge, or whoever leads you astray, a teacher or whatever. There is forgiveness for that. It falls on that person's head who instructed you. Today we have some discussion going on about just what it is that the Sanhedrin Council commanded us to do, and is that proper for us to do that? Is it added to the Torah and so forth? Well, you know, the priests and the judges, those councils that were in every city, and then later on that principle was used to form a Sanhedrin, by the way, of 71, not necessarily 72 men, as Rebekah sent to Jacob, but you get the point, that there were people in control of the activities of the Hebrews there in the land. That council may not be legal, it may not have authority, may not add to or diminish from the Torah. Of course, I don't believe they've ever diminished anything from the Torah, but it appears that at some point they have added some things in there using the principles of the Torah. And, you know, you can disagree with this, but in Deuteronomy chapter 17, we learn about this council and how the Lord has authorized them to make decrees at all levels, whether it's between people or between, the congregation and the priest and the judge. And, you know, we're going to learn some more of that as we study the holiness of Israel. But my point here is that we don't like their decrees, and therefore we sometimes fight against them. We fight against them in perhaps the same way that Jacob did. Perhaps we weep bitterly, but there's the principle that when we are told to do something, whether it's as Jacob following his mother's commands or us following our council's commands up to AD 70, that there is a remedy for that if they have led us astray. You know, Jacob had a mandate to honor his mother and father, and he did. So whatever happened there, his mother, that lays on his mother, okay? And so whatever the Sanhedrin or the Great Assembly has said to us, that lays on them. It's only for us to be obedient. So we see here the principle of obedience regardless of whether we agree. Alright, so then we see now that this is why Jacob did what he did, and the story picks up in Genesis 32 verse 3. It said, "And then Jacob sent messengers ahead of him into the land of Seir." That's where Esau was. He was in the territory of Edom at that time. I've done extensive teachings on Esau, so I don't need to go over what he was doing in the land of Edom, but he was over there. And so now he comes down, and he's going to meet up with his brother Jacob and intends to do him harm because he believes that Jacob is a deceiver, a usurper, and so forth. And Laban has just, quote unquote, confirmed this for Esau. So Jacob goes through some process there of preparing to meet with Esau, and in Genesis 32:24 it says Jacob was left alone, and there he wrestled with a man until the break of the day. And when he, that's the man, saw that he prevailed not against him, Jacob, he, the man, touched the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint as he wrestled with him. So this is Jacob wrestling with the Lord. And you know, when we go back to the land, there is always going to be a wrestling with the Lord. Now, you know, Jacob's name means restrainer. His physical name means restrainer. Now, he gets his name changed here to Israel. Israel is his spiritual name and the name of the nation. And, you know, in 2 Thessalonians verses 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 6 and 7, we learn about the restrainer. It says, you know what it is that is now holding him back. It's restraining him so that he will be revealed when his time comes. What is holding him back? It's the restrainer. It's Israel holding him back. You know, we've been taught over the years that this restrainer that holds things back from happening the way we want them to in the end of days is the Antichrist and so forth. But it's not. Jacob, Israel, you and me, we are the restrainer. And it says in verse 7, for the secret of this lawlessness is already at work, but only until the person now holding it back gets out of the way. Who is that? Again, it's Jacob the restrainer. It's the hand on the heel restraining the foot of Esau. Coming into the end of days, we're going to see that the getting out of the way will involve Israel going into the camps of the righteous. The restrainer goes into the camps of the righteous and allows Esau then, who is the beast and the Antichrist that comes from the beast, to start doing his work. So I thought you would find that just a little bit interesting there. And I want to share with you some more about what happened there when Esau came to meet with Jacob, because Jacob is restraining Esau in the end of days. But in the end of days, we're going to see that there are messengers that are going to restrain the beast from afflicting the Lord's people who are in the camps of the righteous. And so now we go back to the book of Jasher, and we read in Jasher chapter 31 that the Lord has sent three angels of the angels of heaven, and they went before Esau and came to him. And these angels appeared to Esau and his people as 2,000 men riding upon horses furnished with all sorts of war instruments, and they appeared in the sight of Esau and all his men to be divided into four camps with four chiefs to them. And one camp went on, and they found Esau coming with 400 men toward his brother Jacob. And this camp ran toward Esau and his people and terrified them. And Esau fell off the horse in alarm, and all his men separated from him in that place, for they were greatly afraid. So while Jacob was in the throes of wrestling with the man whom you and I know was the Messiah, Yeshua, I've taught on that in the past, and I don't want to get into that because I have other things I want to talk about here. While Jacob was being in this battle with Yeshua, The Lord had sent these three angels of the angels of heaven, and those angels of heaven speak about what's going to happen with us in the end of days as well. So we will be in the camps struggling with Yeshua as we get ready to go back to the land, and the Lord will be dealing with Esau, the beast, and the Antichrist via his angels, via his messengers. And by the way, I think those are probably, but not entirely, comparable with the 144,000 who will be sealed. But also, I believe there's going to be divine intervention with the angels of heaven during the Great Tribulation. And so, Jacob gets done fighting with Yeshua. In other words, he gets his hip knocked out of joint, and now he's going to walk on a different path. You know, when we meet up with the Lord, we get to walk on a little bit slightly different way. We get to limp a little bit until we get healed, because, you know, it hurts when we get our way of thinking changed, doesn't it? And so he limps now. And it says, and he passed over Penuel, the sun rose upon him, and he halted upon his thigh. So he's limping. Now, the rabbinic literature says that, you know, he did heal from this. But it also says there in verse 32 that the children of Israel eat not of the sinew which shrank, which is upon the hollow of the thigh to this day, because he touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh in the sinew that shrank. Now, you and I know about the kosher laws, and in the kosher laws there isn't any mention of this sinew that we don't eat of. Yet here it is in the laws of Moses that we are not to eat that part of the meat. And so what is that in a beef? Well, that's the sirloin, the T-bone, and the filet mignon, because the sciatic nerve has not been removed. Now, if you remove the sciatic nerve out of there, well, you know, then it's kosher. In fact, in kosher slaughterhouses, they do, when they butcher the meat, they do remove the sciatic nerve, and then, you know, they can eat the sirloin, the T-bone, and the filet mignon. But it's kind of interesting. We have, again, in the Hebrew Roots community, a prejudice, kind of, that if it didn't start at Exodus and end at Deuteronomy, then whatever is outside of Exodus and Deuteronomy as laws, we do not, you know, we do not do anything beyond that. But here we have a law that's prior to, and also, and you know, Solomon gave us a law about praying toward Jerusalem. You know, when you pray, you don't want to put your back to Jerusalem. It's part of our kedusha. It's part of our duty toward holiness. Nehemiah, he told us that we need to start the Sabbath earlier than at sundown. And so we honor that because Nehemiah was a governor and a priest. He had the authority to make that kind of decree based upon what was going on in Jerusalem at that time. And I don't want to belabor that point because I want to get on to something else. I want to go on and talk about Jacob's daughter, Dinah. Now, I'm going to say that in this story of Dinah, we have injustice for injustice. First of all, Dinah's name means justice. And she was the only female in the family. She was the only girl child that was born to Jacob. And she had no other sisters to hang out with. And so the story is in the book of Genesis that she goes out to see some other people in the community. She wants to have some friends. And while she's out there getting acquainted with the people in the community, someone saw her. His name was Shechem. Shechem was the son of the king of Shechem, and the city of Shechem had been named for his son. And he defiled Dina. In other words, he raped her. And yet, when he raped her, here's an interesting thing. He fell in love with her. Now, some people say that he was just lustful, but he wanted to marry her. A man who commits rape doesn't usually fall in love with the one that he raped. But this man, I believe, really did love Dina. Now, you need to hang on to that idea, because I'm going to explain something about how it affects us today. Jacob was aware of this, and he told the sons of his sons as they came out of the field. And what happened was that they went to talk to Hamor, the king, there in Shechem. And he said that the soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. I pray that you will give her to him as a wife. And let's make marriages between us. And, you know, give us your daughters and take our daughters, and let's intermarry. Now, there's a couple of ways that you can look at that. In the Chumash on this Parsha, Vayishlach, it says he, that's Jacob, had to experience a moral outrage upon his own flesh and blood right from the beginning. He had to undergo this ordeal so that the world could see in its swift and uncompromising reaction the sacred character of the purity of Jacob and his family, that it could not tolerate what other nations might consider to be commonplace. Now, in past prophecy teachings, I've explained that this has to do with when the Jews went back into the land, and, you know, they, the people there, the Palestinians and the Arabs, would like for the Jews, or for the nation of Israel, to just disappear. And one of the ways to make that happen is to do what happened here in Shechem, when Hamor suggested just going ahead and intermarrying, because how do you make a nation disappear? Well, you intermarry with them, and then you possess their wealth, and they possess yours, and there's no differentiations. And now, because there's no distinction, the Lord has no nation, you see. Well, the Israelites of today and the Israelites back then were not going to have anything to do with that. And so Jacob's sons took action. And the action that they took was to get the men of Shechem, all of them, every man in the tribe, to agree to be circumcised. Now, once they were circumcised, Simeon and Levi went in there and they killed every man in Shechem. And so there's a problem with this. This is why I call this injustice for injustice. You know, they did an injustice to the men of Shechem for the injustice that Shechem did to Dina. And so, the understanding that I want to bring to you this year is a kind of a different angle, having to do with you and I. See, Dina was in the family. You and I are in the family, but like Dina, we are born outside the land of Israel. We're born in exile. And you and I, as Ephraim, we are considered to be the youngest of the tribes. Ephraim was the youngest of Joseph's children. And so we're considered to be the youngest. Dina was the youngest of Leah's children. And so the point here that I'm making is that it seems that justice always comes last with us Hebrews, doesn't it? Simeon and Levi were not considering justice. They were angry and wanting to take revenge. But for us, Dinah represents the injustice of being in exile. And exile is always associated with injustice, even when we, the house of Ephraim, try to return to the land that is now controlled by our older brother. Yes, I'm going into the prodigal son now. I'm going to connect this story of Dinah with the prodigal son because we are not being allowed back into the land, and that is an injustice to us. Do you see the connection of injustice to Dinah with the injustice that is being done to us? And by the way, the injustice being done to us has to do with circumcision. The Jews today do not recognize our circumcision unless we convert to Judaism. And so today, we see that our own brother is impiling injustices up against us in the land because they won't reconcile with us as of yet. Now, this is coming. They are going to reconcile with us, and I see this coming in the last 2 years, I have made more Jewish friends than any other kind of friends, and I see that there is now a dialogue beginning to form. You see, so Shechem, the story of Shechem, the story of Dinah, is not only prophetic of what the Jews face with the Edomite Canaanites in the land, you see, but it's also prophetic of us desiring to be back in the family of Israel. Now, we're being rebuffed. We're not being killed like they killed, Simeon and Levite killed the men of Shechem. But you do know that being in exile is the same as death, right? So while we're being kept in exile and not being allowed to have proper relationships with our Jewish brethren, and we're being kept in exile, it is the same as being killed. It feels the same to us. And so they won't let us back. Now, we have the story of the prodigal son, where the prodigal son does come home. So this has a happy ending, you see. And we have the account in Ezekiel 37, where he says that the two sticks will be made into one stick. So this has a happy ending. But, you know, Jacob was in exile for 20 years. We have been in exile for 2,700 years, but it's been 2,000 years since Yeshua walked on the earth. So basically, we have that prophetic element as well. The 20 years of exile of Jacob and the 2,000 years since Yeshua was here. So we see the prophetic element not only toward what's going on in the land, and by the way, I would agree that those Edomite Canaanites need to be destroyed, and in the end of days, Obadiah tells us that that will happen. But I don't agree with not being able to go home. I just want to go home. But that is up to the Messiah to make that happen. The problem in the story here, though, is that Jacob says that they have made his name to stink, that they have caused some dishonor. And it was not intended by, I don't believe, by Simeon and Levi to do this. But in chapter 34, verse 30, Jacob says, "You have troubled me to make me to stink among the inhabitants of the land." And so we see here how this has some honor and shame aspects to it. What do I mean by that? Well, it's because honor and shame has to do with how we act in the name of our Father. Simeon and Levi, even if we agree that the Shechemites needed we needed to go to war with them, the shame part comes in the unjust way that Simeon and Levi handled this. When someone is circumcised, you can't go kill them. And that pertains to we 10 tribers who are circumcised. Many of us are circumcised physically. We all claim to be circumcised in the heart, yet we're being kept in exile. And so there's a certain amount of dishonor that is being done to the Father when this happens, just as the dishonor of Levi and Simeon when they profaned Jacob's name with their actions. And so this is an honor and shame story. Now, I do want to change tracks here just a little bit, because we're coming up on Hanukkah this year in 2014. And I want to talk about Hanukkah. I want to have two talks here in this Torah portion. One about the Torah portion, and also one about Hanukkah. First of all, I want us to understand that there's a backlash in the Hebrew Roots community against doing anything that is perceived as Jewish. Now, you know, Christians have this backlash, and they say that what you and I do is that Jewish stuff, right? You know, the Sabbath and keeping the feasts and all of that. We say, no, that's not Jewish, but then there's other Jewish things that we don't want to do, like, you know, not eating the sinew from the thigh of an animal. You know, we would not necessarily agree with that, because it isn't part of the law in from Exodus to Deuteronomy regarding the kosher laws, right? And we don't want to do things that the Sanhedrin said we should do, like, you know, keeping Hanukkah and Purim and doing the Amidah, for instance. You know, we want to, that we regard that as Jewish stuff, yet we understand that the Lord authorized the council and made it possible for the congregation as a whole to be forgiven of any things that they might ask us to do that the Lord didn't want us to do. And, you know, he's coming back and he's going to set all these things right. Yet we aren't willing to put our obedience out there and say, you know, if they said it in the Sanhedrin, then I'm going to do it. And really, there aren't that many things in the Sanhedrin that apply to us to begin with, but we're just not willing to go that far. Just like the Christians are not willing to do the Jewish Sabbath and feast and kosher things, we still have that Christian baggage with us, don't we? And so we're not making the distinction in the Hebrew Roots community between the oral laws that the Jews turned into traditions, or I should say that their traditions that they turned into oral laws, that those are the things that Yeshua did not want us to keep. And we're not making the distinction between what he did not want us to keep and what he did want us to keep. Because, as I just said, there were traditions that became part of their oral law. And then there were practices that were instituted and implemented by the authorized Great Council or Sanhedrin. And those are the things that Yeshua did do, like Hanukkah. You see, Yeshua kept Hanukkah. And so one of the reasons why we have this short-sightedness is because we have had some of the books removed from our canon. As a matter of fact, the book of Maccabees, the books, rather, of Maccabees have been removed, and it is in there that we find out about Hanukkah. And, you know, we say if it's not in our Bible, it can't be correct. Well, you know, this canonized Bible has been messed with. It was messed with at the end of the 19th century, and again in the 20th century, and it's just been messed with. And so, you know, if it's not in our Bible, we're not going to keep it. So, here's what we know about Hanukkah from the book of Maccabees. In the first book of Maccabees, 1 Maccabees chapter 4, starting at verse 41, it says, "Then Judas," who was Judas? It was Judah Maccabee, or he was also called Judas Maccabeus, because, you know, Greece had overrun Israel at that time, and Greece was the captor of Israel. But Judah Maccabee was a Kohen. He was a priest, and he was a son of the priest Mattathias. And he led the Maccabean revolt against the Seleucid Empire, against Antiochus. And he is credited with being one of the greatest warriors in Jewish history, alongside Joshua, Gideon, and David. Okay? So that's who Judas is. It says here, "Then Judas appointed certain men to fight against those that were in the fortress until he had cleansed the sanctuary." So they've had the battle. He's up cleansing the sanctuary. Okay? And in verse 42, he says, "So he chose priests of blameless conversation, such as had pleasure in the law, who cleansed the sanctuary and bare out the defiled stones to an unclean place." So, you remember that Antiochus came in, he sacrificed a pig on the Lord's altar and defiled it. So now they're cleaning up the sanctuary and they're removing the altar stones. Verse 44. "And when, as they consulted what to do with the altar of burnt offerings, which was profaned, they thought it best to pull it down, lest it should be a reproach to them, because the heathen had defiled it. Therefore they pulled it down. And laid up the stones in the mountain of the temple in a convenient place until there should come a prophet to show what should be done with them." You'll remember when Yeshua was up on Temple Mount and he talked about the stones that the Lord could use to raise up prophets. You know, that's the stones they're talking about. "Then they took whole stones according to the law, and built a new order according to the former, and made up the sanctuary and the things that were there within the temple, and hallowed the courts. And they made also new holy vessels, and into the temple they brought the candlestick, and the altar of burnt offerings, and of incense, and the table. And upon the altar they burned incense, and the lamps that were upon the candlestick they lighted, that they might give light in the temple. Furthermore, they set the loaves upon the table, and spread out the veils, and finished all the works which they had begun to make. Now, on the 25th day of the 9th month, which is called the month of Kislev," or Kaslu, it says here in Maccabees. "So on the 25th day of Kislev, in the 148th year," that's 148 years prior to Yeshua being born, "they rose up in the morning and offered sacrifice according to the law upon the new altar of burnt offerings which they had made. Look at what time and what day the heathen had profaned it, even in that it was dedicated with songs and cisterns and harps and cymbals. Now I'm going to take a break right there because this very next section is very important for us to understand regarding Hanukkah. And, you know, I want you to understand that I'm doing this because we need to keep Hanukkah. There are some among us who say that Hanukkah is a pagan holiday. They say Purim is a pagan holiday. They are absolutely wrong. And I will tell you that if you're believing that Hanukkah is a pagan holiday, that you are against the Lord's altar. I know those are strong words, but Hanukkah, even though the symbol of it is the burning of the Hanukkah, the celebration is about the altar. We need to get in line with this altar. It's going to be set up soon, and we need to be celebrating it. We need to be anticipating it. We need to be praying for this altar to get set up. So for any one of us in the Hebrew Roots community to say that this altar is pagan, I can't even get into the reasoning behind that, okay? But I have stopped here because I want to say that this is very important. This is very important in our keeping the ways of the Lord, okay? Hanukkah was kept by Yeshua. Hanukkah is very important for the Lord's altar. And then this very next verse is going to tell you why you need to keep Hanukkah. In 1 Maccabees chapter 4, verse 55, it says, "Then all the people fell upon their faces, worshiping and praising the God of heaven who had given them good success. And so they kept the dedication of the altar 8 days and offered burnt offerings with gladness and sacrificed the sacrifice of deliverance and praise. They decked also the front of the temple with crowns of gold and with shields, and the gates and the chambers they renewed and hanged doors on them. Thus was there very great gladness among the people, for the reproach of the heathen was put away. Moreover, Judas and his brethren, with the whole congregation of Israel, ordained that the days of the dedication of the altar should be kept in their season from year to year by the space of 8 days, from the 25th day of Kislev, with mirth and gladness." Now, you know, at Mount Sinai, it was the whole congregation that said, you know, we're going to do this. And when they said that, they made it incumbent upon you and me to do the things that were said there at Mount Sinai. Again, we have the whole congregation of Israel with the priesthood saying, we're going to do this. My friends, the principle from the Torah is that if the congregation says it over here, then when they say something else over here, it's the same principle. We are indebted to keep the Torah there from the time of Mount Sinai, just like now we're indebted to keep this Hanukkah celebration because the whole congregation of Israel ordained it, you see? And it says in 1 Maccabees 4, verse 60, "At that time also they built up Mount Zion with high walls and strong towers round about, lest the Gentiles should come and tread it down as they had before. And they set there a garrison to keep it, and fortified Bethsura to preserve it, that the people might have a defense against Idumea." So now you see that that altar is also a defense against the Edomites, who are the Idumeans of Idumea. They are the Edomites. Idumea is a Greek translation for the word Edomite. This altar, I cannot stress enough how important this altar is to us. Hanukkah, implemented as a result of the desire of the entire congregation. Hanukkah is the celebration of Jehovah's altar. Hanukkah is not a pagan celebration. In fact, you know, I personally believe, and I believe in past teachings I've shown quite enough evidence, that Yeshua was conceived at Hanukkah. He kept Hanukkah. You see, in John 22 and 23, it says, and it was at Jerusalem, the feast of the dedication. And it was winter, and Yeshua walked in the temple in Solomon's porch. He kept Hanukkah. So I want you to consider opening up your heart and your mind to do those things that are outside of that space between Exodus and Deuteronomy. We need... When we were in the church, we all thought, there's got to be more to this. Well, the Lord gave us Torah laws and principles in those laws that we can see now were used to govern the people in times in other cultures where they were, and in dealing with the Greeks in Jerusalem and with the altar and so forth. It is incumbent upon us to investigate exactly what more the Lord wants from us if we are going to qualify as the royal priesthood. I have said this in the past, and I'll say it again. I believe that every one of us is a candidate for being in the order of Melchizedek priesthood that's coming. But we can disqualify ourselves. And if we are not willing to ask the Lord, what more do you want? What more have you said? What more have you authorized, and where can I find these things? If we're not willing to do that, then it may be, I'm not saying it is, I'm saying it may be a point of disqualification from being in the priesthood. Now, you won't be kept out of the family, you won't be kept out of the kingdom, but I don't want to be disqualified from the priesthood, and I don't know that there isn't something I've done that hasn't already disqualified me from the priesthood. I mean, none of us really know, but I think it behooves us all to go ahead and just make the effort to find out what those additional things might be. One of the things that the Sanhedrin did every month was to decree the calendar. The Hillel calendar. The Hillel calendar back then is exactly the same calendar that we have now. Yes, it's calculated. It's not calculated and cited like they did in Jerusalem, but it's the same Hillel calendar. And until the Lord returns to straighten these things out, who are we to say that we shouldn't be keeping that calendar, or that we should view Hanukkah and Purim as pagan holidays? By the way, you know, Purim is 1,290 days before the return of Yeshua. Did you know that? Daniel talks about the 1,290 days. We leave to go into the Great Tribulation at the 1,260-day mark at Passover. But Purim always comes 30 days before Passover, and oh, by the way, 30 days prior to 1,260 days is the 1,290 days. Now, I don't find anywhere in my Bible that the Lord has ever used a pagan holiday as a pivotal point for a prophecy. We need to step back from our baggage that we've carried with us. You know, this is indicative of the idols that Rachel brought out from Laban's house, this baggage, you see. We need to step back from that and start to get some sense about us and say that, you know, there's more to this walk than just what we see on the surface. And, you know, we need to stop turning a blind eye, and we need to stop denouncing the things of the Lord, you know, this altar and the starting point of His great tribulation, Hanukkah and Purim, as being pagan. Now, I know that I probably have ruffled some feathers, and some of you will have, you know, thoughts about this and so forth. I ask you to just pray about it, okay? Just pray and ask the Lord what more He would have you do in regard to your qualification to be a part of that royal priesthood. I hope this Torah portion has been a blessing to you.